Welcome to the Educause podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the Educause 2008 annual conference presented by Eileen McMahon, Senior Instructional Designer at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. The session is entitled, The Anatomy of a Course Designed Like a Video Game.
Thank you so much for that warm welcome. That's great. Maybe a little more introduction. I thought I might need just this presentation is going to talk about an undergraduate course I teach for the Communication Studies Department called Using Internet Communications, which I teach two semesters a year, and most recently last summer, and going to talk about the features that resemble a video game as well as the challenges and the rewards that arise from adapting a curriculum like this. And just to mention also that this course is also published on our OpenCourseWare site if you want to go in and look at it. A little bit more about my background, just in terms of kind of the pedagogical forces that influenced me. I was an undergraduate at Bennington College, very much of an active learning curriculum, doing in school, and then did graduate work at Harvard and MIT. With Harvard being a collaborative curriculum, as well as constructivist, and MIT being very much of a constructivist school. And then I worked in entertainment and technology for the first 20 years of my career. I was in high tech, working for Lotus, Apple, and Microsoft, and then was in LA for 10 years working in entertainment and education, mostly in children's media and design. And worked on a lot of video games as well as theme parks, did a lot of work for Universal and Disney, and think that, and in that course of doing that, especially taking from the Graduate School of Education, we have a really wonderful Center for Children's Media, brought a lot of those research methods and observational research and different techniques to my role as a designer. So I did a lot of observation of children playing games, and that was really fun and informed, I think, a lot of my ideas about how the learning experiences for video game design. Sorry, I'm a Mac person, so I'm a little game elements. So given that, I think one of the things, and this is an online course for communication studies, so these are the features that, I mean, this is by no means a limited, this is not to say that these are the only features which I would say are video game-like, but these are the, I think it could be a really much larger list, but these are the things that I think are characteristic of, for me, really are important to make it work like a video game. I'm sorry? Oh, you can't see it. Okay. So. Oh, okay. Can you see that now? If I go, there's no. So much easier on the Mac. So I did that at the introduction, my background. And then game elements. So this is one of the first game elements for me in a course. I've really, every assignment in my course is worth points. And my students can currently earn up to 124 points. So to earn an A, my student needs to accumulate 100 points. So I've got optional, basically, points there. And I think this is really important. A point-like structure makes it kind of more fun because you can keep track of points and you can think about different strategies, when you're collecting them. I'm going to talk a little about, we use it in learning management system. I'm going to talk later about the challenges. I think that we're in the middle of a paradigm switch away from LMS, is looking at more fluid kind of tools producing. We have a wonderful SIG in New England, the Northeast Educause, NERCOM, and I'm producing a meeting in March on widgets and gadgets, and I think that that's really kind of an exciting direction right now, the ability to embed widgets and gadgets in curriculum and things like PageFlakes and Net5s and allow, and but there are some missing pieces to that in terms of collecting things. So that's point structure. And another element is multi-paced. What I've observed in my students is that students work in typically two paces, evenly or in bursts. And I think that this is also as a result of the typical student at UMass is working full-time as well as taking a course and completing their degree and typically have children. So it's really challenging for them to balance a lot of things with all of those things on their plate. And so a lot of times they just have, you know, in 1 week they might have 8 hours to sit down and really do their work. So I think about that when I design a course, that that I'm going to have some students who can log in every day and spend 2 hours in the course, and some students are just going to have to be able to, you know, work in a solid element of time. So my course is designed for both types of students. And not just even in that week. Also, we're all working. We sometimes go out of town, and we have projects, and so that we can't log in and do any work for 2 weeks. So I think about that. I think about designing activities where a student can come back after being away for 2 weeks and catch up and do a lot of work. And I think there's some other forces that are changing the way we think about time in the way curriculum is structured. When curriculum, you know, going back five thousand years from Socrates and the lecture format, we had time as a major element in designing curriculum, and now time is changing. We're in a digital time. And I think that the forces with that digital time, meaning electronic, all the electronic media that pervade in our lives, also makes it very difficult to work in concentration the way we might have 20 years ago. In fact, I saw an article in the New York Times 2 weeks ago about how our concentration span over the last 20 years has really markedly decreased, and our average attention span is 11 minutes. And they reported in this study that if we weren't interrupted every 11 minutes, we would interrupt ourselves. Someone didn't interrupt us, we'd interrupt ourselves. So it speaks to the fact that getting concentrated, deep thinking of time is not typical, and that we have to assume that when students are learning in our courses that they are also, you know, that they have these forces. And but also, it kind of, I probably informed from my work in leading edge technology companies, I noticed that innovation happens in bursts as well. That when we have a deadline to solve a new product, you have to get out the door, that knowing you have 24 hours and the kind of the acceleration and I think the exhilaration that happens in that is also very typical of our innovation patterns in America. And so I think this is, you know, a kind of a realistic way to think about course design. I might just, take questions as they come up. If you have questions, and also take questions at the end if you have questions about this. Okay. Another game-like element is optional points. So I have some optional points and some required fewer required ones. And to accomplish this, I use Teaching for Understanding framework. I think it's really important to have a framework, a very structured environment, structured curriculum, as we think about multi-customized learning for students and multi-paths to learning. So the idea of optional points, more optional assignments and fewer required ones. And I think this is where the framework is really important. Again, I use the Teaching for Understanding framework, which focuses, instead of learning outcomes, is really performance outcomes. But if you have a really structured curriculum, you can think, what is really essential? What are the essential? What are the performances I want my students to walk out? The essential things they have to walk out of the door knowing, and what are the nice to haves and the other things, and when you can really categorize those performance outcomes, you can think about what's optional and what's required for students. The other element is clear and consistent rules at the course start, and it's always surprising to me working with faculty at my university how often that's not the case for a course. That there's, you know, you have, when you use percentages, for instance, you know, it's not very, and that's the advantage of using points over percentages, is you don't know. A student really needs to know at the beginning of a course, just like a video game, what the challenges are, and think about all the different strategies that they can be successful. And so when you start a game, you think about, okay, I'm going to, knowing that these are the major points I have to hit, I think I'm going to do this and that, and I'm going to spend a little time here. And so you develop a strategy at the very beginning of a game, and similarly, students do that in a course. But then also life intervenes, and things happen, and things change, so you need to change your strategy, so you need to know, again, having that overview, you can rethink your strategy and to be successful. So this is really important that that everything is stated, the point value of the assignments, the grade value of assignments, the use of rubrics, and a late assignment policy. I accept late assignments in my course. I just take points off for them, because what I really want my students to do is learn something, and if they can learn it, you know, in the first 2 weeks, or they can learn it in the last week, it doesn't matter to me. As you know, I just want to know that they've learned it. So that kind of flexibility. But I think really the difference, of course, in an online course is everything is very front-loaded. From my video game design experience too, I do think of my designing a course as a learning experience, but really I think a more apt metaphor is a ride. I think when I design a course of designing a roller coaster ride, and you know, just like when you go onto a roller coaster, I had a great Google party a couple of days ago doing the Hulk, and just but be able to see the, you know, where you're going, you can look up at the roller coaster and kind of see where it's going to go, so you kind of can map on what it's going to feel like, and then when you get on, there's a, I think the fun of a ride is not knowing exactly what it's going to be like when you turn those corners and what you're going to see. So those elements of surprise. So I do keep, like, there are some faculty, for instance, that I don't believe in putting all my curriculum materials out there so students can see everything. I actually hide through selective release in Blackboard all of the weekly sessions because I want there to be that element of surprise. But I do lay out the basic terrain. I give every week what topics are going to be covering, what kind of activities we're going to be doing, again, allow them to figure out what their strategy is going to be for success. Another important element of the game is objectivity, that the assessment measures are clear and consistently applied, and all the students get the same amount of information. I've observed in my years of teaching, and I taught actually at UCLA for 10 years before I taught it at UMass Boston, that there are always students who, you know, want to find a way to get more information, you know, about the course and, you know, from you. And I think that's my own observation is that's kind of really unfair to the other students. And oftentimes, what I've seen is the difference between an A student and a B student is not necessarily their intellectual ability, but their ability, ability to really understand what the professor wants to be successful in the course. And because other students don't lack some of those skills, it's really essential to be objective about the way they're going to be measured. And rubrics are really, really terrific with that. And that they're, you know, it's funny with Blackboard, it makes it very difficult to see the rubric before, it's kind of before a student is, you actually grade their work. And I have to make PDFs of my rubrics and put them out in my module, in my project module, to make sure that students use them. And they use them as checklists, and I always ask them to do that. Make sure you look at the rubric and go through everything before you submit it to me so that it's important. But a lot of times, there's always the case where I come across a student and they submit their work and they did something I didn't expect. And I didn't, you know, but because the rubric said that that was, you know, that could be an A, then I have to go give them that grade too. So that means making sure my rubrics typically go through. I'm sure you have a lot of experience using rubrics too, but typically they're always being kind of changed and modified, and I'm always kind of tweaking them. But I have to, you know, it's really important that objectivity. And I think that's really the fun of the game, knowing that everyone's going to get the same, you know, be able to collect points and proceed in a game in the same way that other people have. And then there's the element of pleasant surprises. I tell my students in the beginning of the course that there are going to be bonus optional assignments. They don't appear until the middle of the course, because at that point my students are kind of able to, I ask them to look at the points that they, you know, that they've accumulated in the course through the grade book and start thinking about strategies for, do they need some bonus points. So I don't tell my students when they're going to appear. But they do come up with selective release. They're kind of windows of opportunity that help them increase the chances of getting the grade they want. And I think this is a really important element to bring, you know, because what I see working again with faculty is the courses tend to be very flat and predictable. But learning is very unpredictable and lots of surprises, and that's really also the fun of life. So to bring that in, to have those elements and reward students for kind of, you know, logging in and wanting to see what's going on. And then freedom. There are multiple routes to a good grade, and students are free to make choices and then reevaluate them along the way. I think this is a really important part of the American learning experience. I read a paper recently that talked about how American students being able to choose the different courses that they take as an undergraduate means that everyone, like, you know, let's say you're an English major, when you come out as an English major at the same university, you haven't taken the same courses as the other English major. And that means that the different courses that you've taken to make up your curriculum have different kinds of connections and different kinds of meaning. And that this has really given us a kind of a cognitive advantage, and maybe one of the elements that's really tied to American creativity and uniqueness in a higher ed. So I think it's really important to have this element as well, and to let students think about, you know, again, at the very beginning, how am I going to get an A? This is the path I'm going to take, but then be able to change that because maybe they didn't get as good a grade on this project in the midterm, so they're going to think about other ways to do that.
So the student knows their grade every step of the way from how they performed on the game, right?
Right, in the curriculum. Well, I try to grade assignments as quickly as possible, because it is me on the back end of the of grading students, and that's a good point, because the assignments that I do for my students, I have a rule that I tell faculty to at UMass that only have two times in the course where they are giving their student detailed feedback, and the other times are student feedback, group feedback, or assignments which are really easily graded. So I think a lot about being able to, I think that may be another slide coming up, but when I'm designing activities, I think about things that can be graded really easily, but really give, evaluate the learning that's taking place. A good example of that is a scorecard assignment I do. I have an assignment where I want to introduce students to a lot of Web 2.0 tools, social networking tools. So I give them a scorecard, And I give them choices about the, you know, for instance, they can, I want them to go look at photo blogs so that they have, or photo blogging sites, so they have three or four choices. They go off and evaluate one in that category and rate it for me, and then they go back, and then they go to, they might go to a video sharing site and evaluate those. So, but those, that that activity, you know, very time intensive for a student to go in to be able to evaluate what's the user friendliness of this site, what's the content like, how is it organized and so forth, really gives or very, you know, really all the analytical skills that I want them to apply. But for me, it's very easy when I go in to grade it. So I have a lot of assignments like that that I think about, again, knowing the performances that I want them to demonstrate by the mastery of the assignment, but are easy for me and also fun for them to do. Multimedia is another element. I have a very different approach to course design. Again, coming back to the idea that I'm designing a learning experience and really a roller coaster ride for my students. I try to make use of as much public resources for my course. Of course, I have a course that's very fast moving and there's a lot of material out there, but I create very little of it. For me, it's really, I make use of as much public video and other resources to communicate the key concepts. And so that keeps me free to focus on designing the learning experience and not in the content, which is very, very intensive, labor intensive. And I don't have an assistant to work with that. And there's some wonderful sites out there too. So, but when I think about a concept that I want to communicate to my students, I usually always try to find a paper, and then I try to find a video, on the same subject, and so that my students have options about whether they want to read something or they just want to kick back and relax with a video. There are a variety of sources that I use from, so it's not just one source, but like things like, I do try to make use of nonprofit, the TED conference, and my field is great. I have a lot of lectures from there, but there are a lot of other just public sites, and I'm not concerned about advertising, if that's what you're thinking about, but there are some good just educational video sites, but they don't always necessarily have everything I have, so it's a wide collection from YouTube to other sources as well. And not just video, but multimedia. In this field, there's a lot of techniques to things. It might be, for instance, my students, for instance, work on a group project as a virtual team where they use a wiki to create a map mashup of the Boston Harbor Islands. They are developing web publishing skills in that and also learning how to create mashups and use Google Docs and edit photos and things like that. So there are techniques that they have to develop. So I found a lot of great sites that just kind of walk my students through how to do this. How do you resize a photo, you know, and or also just key concepts like, you know, what is delicious, what is a social bookmark and things like that. So I only create things if I really have to, and I try to make them multimedia. And because online courses tend to be very text intensive, and that is a whole, I think, when I think about the interface and the graphical, you know, the environment that students are in, it really requires a whole different set of cognitive skills to be successful in an online course from a class, you know, a classroom, because of the icons and the computer expertise and this other layer of things. So I think it's already very intensive in the text processing and the problem solving and logic, so I try to focus on the as much as possible on the visual. Mentioned about timely feedback, so this is really important. When I design my assignments, I think about designing activities that I can grade very easily or can be graded very easily, with the exception of two projects, which is actually I have my students do a final paper. Their final papers in Google Docs, so they're multimedia papers where they have links to images. They have embed tags to YouTube. They have hyperlinks, and they peer review them with each other. So, but anyway, so when they submit proposals for those, I take a lot of time to think through their proposal. Although I give them, if you go into the Open Courseware site, you'll see that I give them choices about papers, because I've found that it's a lot easier, and this is a kind of a game-like element too, that where you can have, I give them 12 possible topics that they could focus on for their final paper. I also give them the option of adding their own, but it gets them started about thinking about the range of topics that I'm thinking of. But anyway, that's the one that I give them, spend a lot of time helping them with suggestions about crafting their paper, and then at the end, when I'm evaluating their final paper, grading their final paper. Another element of a game in a curriculum is peer pressure and the ability to show off and demonstrate what you can do in a group is really motivational to students. And peer reviews are part of that. And open repositories are important too. So when my students are working on their wiki projects, for instance, I ask them all to post the URL to their wiki in a public discussion forum, so they can all go in and kind of gauge each other's, you know, how are they doing, did they get further than we did, you know, did they get more videos? Because that is, it's fun. It's fun to and motivational for other people to see that. And I also open up the team discussions. I presented the Blackboard conference 2 years ago on creating a video game in Blackboard, and actually collaborated with the University of Lowell, and we created a video game, a trivia game, and it was just interesting to go in and kind of see the limitations, to discover the limitations we found in using a learning management system to create a real game-like elements. But one of the things I always trip up on, you know, with Blackboard is these kind of elements that are really not designed for this kind of thing. For instance, if you create through the group tool, if you go to create groups, discussion boards, students can't see those discussion boards. But that's really motivational for other students to see that. You know, you divide up in a group to see, did they come to a better conclusion? How many more resources did they have? You know, let's kind of like gauge each other. So the ability for individuals to kind of be able to strut their stuff, to show what they can do, but also for groups to do that with each other. And then there's social learning. Students work together and learn from each other through observation, collaboration, and negotiation. So I think it's important that students try on multiple roles, novice, expert, and coach, and that this idea of evaluating each other. And I don't think that we're as good, you know, it's always surprising to me, group projects are really difficult. I think there's a certain amount of ingredients that group projects really need. It's like a recipe, and if you kind of miss some of those elements, they don't really kind of come together. It's always surprising and disappointing to me to see, you know, at UMass, for instance, if you walk around in a classroom, you see a lot of group collaboration happening, but if you go into an online environment, it's not as frequent because group projects are really challenging to put together. You have a question? Well, the one project that's required, because I said some things are required and some things are optional, the virtual team project in my course is required. So I tell students that at the onset, and it's going to be a 4-week project. But I also give them strategies for being successful, because it's typical that my students are out of town for a week or maybe part of that group project. And so I coach them through and give them tips for doing that. For how to front load things so that they take on a role. And in the group projects, they all have a role. I think it's really important in a group project for every, you know, students can easily spend a couple weeks just kind of figuring out what people are going to do. So I assign a team lead for each group. That's based on their skill set. I have a survey that they fill out in the very beginning. So I kind of get a sense of what their skills are. I'm looking for someone who has kind of a good sense of basically a intermediate or advanced computer user. And so anyway, have that person nailed, and then in the team they can choose other optional roles, but I have those clearly defined, and so that they have clear deliverables. And within that project, those deliverables, for instance, in the wiki project, it's finding they have to have, a photo editor would have to have 3 images per page, so that they know they have to have 12 images that pertain to their island, so that they can do that, really throughout the project. The same thing with the other tasks. They create RSS feeds and for on their topic, and then the map blog. So that even though there's a lot of coordination in the project, they can they know what the points are. I kind of scaffold the group project too. I make recommendations, like they should have a meeting in the first week. We have a Wimba so that they can go online, and that they need to have a meeting at the end as well. So that the very beginning of the project, they can kind of kick that off. But again, because I tell them that's required at the beginning, I tell them what weeks it's going to happen, and I also open up that project, all the requirements for that project at the beginning of the course. Even though I don't open up the week-by-week things, I do open up the projects, the final paper, and the group project, all the rubric, all the tools, the whole scope of the project and everything, so that they can plan. And I do tell them in the first week to take a look through it and think about, how they might organize themselves. So I hope I answered that question. The end? Okay, I'll repeat that question. How do you structure a course where you have optional assignments versus required, and students could walk out without having taken all of the required elements? Is that right?
Well, I gather they would have taken them because they're required, but if they didn't perform well.
If they didn't perform well.
Yeah, then they might have a high grade, but the performance on core competencies is actually really low.
So their performance is on lower, core competencies are low. Well, that's where I think the structure is really important. Again, if you, in the very beginning of this frame, you have a framework, and you think these I want my students to have. So how I've done that is I have the final paper and the midterm project are worth the most points. They're 20 points each. Neither one are required, but the first half of the course are a lot of required assignments, so that the kind of the requirements are kind of front-loaded. It's very much of a scaffolded course too, where I'm introducing a lot of tools. So that's why I do that. Is I have some assignments which are required, and they're tied to these core competencies. But other ones are more of an opportunity to exercise the same skills in a different way, or more like practices, like the final paper, for instance. But I think it comes back to a framework in a very disciplined way. And it's interesting to me about how difficult that is. That very unlike game-like experience, by the way, the discipline, it really used to frustrate me. I was working for Activision. I was producing a game from Muppet Treasure Island, and I wanted to do something. They actually had the game, the characters were really much better for a younger group, and they were thinking about that from an older group. But we sat down to think about the game design, and it's typically in a game, it's very collaborative. You've got a group of people, the art director and the programmer, and they immediately start to think about games that they had played that they really liked. We want to throw a couple of features this way and do this. And then in the end, this is the typical game development process, by the way, in that universe, is that it's very unusual to start from the very beginning to say, what do we want to accomplish? What are the takeaways? It requires a very disciplined, structured way to creating learning experiences, and it's very atypical in the game environment. In fact, it's funny when you go to a game that we have a wonderful game developer show, the Game Developers Conference. It's in San Jose every year. But when you go there and you see the games, it's always the same thing. Everyone's doing basically, taking each other's ideas and kind of taking them just one step further, but they're all a lot of the same. So this kind of way of designing curriculum like a video game really requires a lot of structured thinking. I think that I was informed, or this very much influenced by my work at Harvard with the work in Sesame Street. They had a School of Education at Harvard was involved in the development of Sesame Street, and they did a lot of research and educational design, and that was really the first venture of thinking, how do I blend entertainment with entertainment with education? And how they did that was really having a very specific learning objectives, performance objectives for their students, and then for the viewers, and then each objective was tied to an activity, which was often repeated and then woven into it. So it's interesting. I think educators have the patience for that, but the entertainment industry typically doesn't. Another story about that is working on a show for Sony and CBS, a game show for 8 to 12 year olds, and I had been doing a lot of work for public television in the schools, and I had learned about a constructivist spelling way to spell for children, so that you have children would memorize kind of rules about letters and how patterns, so that they could identify whether a word was misspelled. And so when I went into a development meeting at CBS, I thought, oh, this would be great to bring this element into the game design. But they didn't have because it was like a World of Fortune. It was but it had a lot of puzzle elements to it. It was a World of Fortune game, but. They didn't want the entertainment, CBS and Sony didn't want to sit there and have to think through how that would work, They wanted to make it look educational, but really be entertainment, because they didn't really buy into that idea that things could be truly educational and entertaining at the same time. But so it's interesting. And then I also do a lot of, in that period, actually feedback from kids. I have a big background in research and focus groups and observational research, and got a lot of great recommendations from students, from kids about the games, and they also kind of totally threw those out. But anyway, I think this switch to designing curriculum that's entertaining does require a lot of pre-planning, really thinking through all the each step of the way and each learning goal and overarching goal and performances. Variety is another thing I think about when in my course, that my assignments are varied and designed to engage a lot of different kinds of learning styles. Again, being a Harvard graduate, very influenced by the multiple intelligence model. But I found, this is another thing I did as a game designer, I came in a lot of times to work as a consultant on game design for Disney. And a bunch of other companies, Lifespan Partnership, Math Games, and not just entertainment, a lot of them were, because they were children, were supposed to be elements of education. But I love to use Howard Gardner's idea of the multiple intelligence framework. So I'd say, okay, we want to teach kids how to add. Let's see, how can we do that by combining musical intelligence with visual intelligence? And I was always able to come up with something really, really cool and unique within using that framework. So it's the same thing with my course. I think about, as I look through all the assessments and the assignments, I want to see a variety of different kinds of things that are going to engage different kinds of learners. And to make it really multidimensional. That is another fault I see when I look at other courses, online courses at UMass. It's hard that typically faculty fall into a pattern where they have the assignment is the same thing. The typical course at UMass is a reading, discussion, a midterm, and a final paper. And if you can imagine, putting yourself in the student's perspective, you're taking four courses like that, and they're all the same pace. It's not as motive. First of all, it's really easy to get them confused, but it's also they're all the requirements are kind of happening at the same time. So, again, how I get to variety of assignments, I typically brainstorm a bunch of different ways that I could have the assignment and the assessment work, and then kind of think about, well, what have I already done? If I've already done a scorecard, I've already done one of those, I'll do something else. And I also use a lot of tools that I like in Blackboard is the ability to do peer reviews with discussions. And you do a lot of really think of discussion boards, although I don't actually use discussions a lot in a typical way. I use them more to evaluate, for students to brainstorm ideas and evaluate each other's things so that they're really interacting with one another. Probably mention too is my design philosophy, going back to designing curriculum kind of like a roller coaster ride. I do try to stay out of the way for my students, and I get involved very seldom in the middle of the learning experience as I think about crafting, a learning goals, and then I really stay on the side. And so I try to do as much peer review and peer activities, centric activities as I can. I guess I've talked about this scaffolded learning, and my course does introduce a lot of new Web 2.0 skills to novice and intermediate computer users. And I think a lot of my students initially, it's kind of intimidating in the first couple of weeks. They wonder if it's a computer course, but they're all very easy to use. I mean, how to use, how to post a photo up on Flickr. How to create tags in a map. So I introduce these skills usually two every week as I build up. And then in their team project, there's a lot of new skills that they're putting together and help kind of coaching each other through. They each at that point are responsible for one thing, the new skill that they have to kind of demonstrate. But then in their final paper, they're using... I'm looking for a demonstration of their kind of mastery of ability to use all of these tools in concert. And again, Google Docs is a really great way. It's really a lot of fun for students to do that because they can easily peer review each other's work, give comments, share it, and add links. And it really creates a really nice finished project in terms of the appearance. So these are the challenges that I faced in designing a curriculum like a video game. That the content management system, the one again we use is Blackboard, BLS Vista, is very hierarchical rather than peer-centered. So I think of ourselves as the first generation tools that we have to move, as I mentioned in the beginning, that I look at moving away from. I think we're in this paradigm shift, and we'll see, starting to see this ability to create curriculum with gadgets and widgets and being able to really customize and create a lot more customization for that. But currently, it's hard to create individualized learning paths. Selective release, to me, is very much like a smoke and mirrors kind of thing, because that was something that I explored with the designing the video game, is can I create, how much can I create individualized learning paths, and you can only do it with one activity. But I would love to see a content management system or a system that allowed me to add sound effects. So at the beginning of an activity, I get some kind of dun-dun-dun-dun, and then, I'm going through it, and then maybe in the midway, I get some other kind of audio feedbacks, and then at the end, a visual and auditory feedback that, says, yay, so those kinds of things would really make it fun and more... more video game-like, but also I might be able to choose between what kind of, knowing my learning style, if I did a survey on learning preferences in the beginning, I could give customized feedback to my students based on that. So those are a certain amount of frustration. I think, 5 minutes, thank you. Time-consuming is another thing. Right now, learning management is very time-consuming. It's very front-loaded. I typically spend about... 40 or 50 hours on my course the week before, before it starts, really to get everything all set. And it should be a lot easier than that to do that. And that's not just up, so it's time consuming. I mentioned adding special effects like audio and video, first generation tools. Collaboration is very difficult in a course management system like Blackboard. I have a faculty member who teaches. I teach it two semesters, someone else that teaches it one semester. And I would love it to be like a wiki where I could go in and see what did they add, when I wasn't teaching it, what resources, but I can't do that. So we end up having to develop in parallel, and as opposed to kind of be able to leverage each other's ideas for content. Another challenge is that the internet is a very fast-moving terrain, so that there's an explosion of Web 2.0 tools. I'm in a situation where I have to constantly prune and replace the content I'm using. And then I go through an annual curriculum redesign, which is really nice when I'm not teaching it, to sit back and think about, do I want to replace this project with something else, or what skill is, you know, again, going back to my performance outcomes, what do I really want them to take away? But I think the other challenge for students is that this kind of learning experience is not for a student who likes to read and write a lot of papers, because it's very hands-on. It's more of a constructivist learning, and it requires students to be really actively engaged and to log on to the course regularly, even though I understand that they may be out, not be able to do that at some intervals, but they can't just kind of log in at the beginning of the course and then log in at the middle and then the end. But on the rewards, it's really fun to teach a course like this. As I said, now that it's front-loaded, I actually do very little work during the course. I mean, other than kind of coaching students, but it's not very time-consuming. In fact, I have a rule when I design that, because actually teaching is a second job for me, and I'm also a single mom and have a very demanding full-time job, so I design it so it doesn't require more than 8 hours a week of my time while I'm teaching it. And in terms of, you know, the feedback I get from students frequently tell me that they're happy that they took my course, that they developed many new skills, and that they became more effective students in their other courses, which is really rewarding. Because I have, in the last year in particular, I introduced Zotero. How many of you using Zotero for references? It's a great tool, and it was really, you know, it was part of one of those scaffolded experiences where my students are using how to create bibliographies with Zotero and be able to, you know, export them and use them in their final paper. And a lot of my students said that was like the best thing that I learned, is because it's saved me so much time now when I'm writing papers in other courses. So I have a blog at UMass. If you want to blog in, log into my blog and comment, do it next week, because we're about to launch it next week. And then also, if you have any questions, you can email me. So thank you very much for coming. And it's some questions, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, I'm going to put them up right after this. So I'll put them up on the EDUCAUSE site. On the EDUCAUSE site, I can also post them to my blog as well.
Excellent, thank you. You mentioned that the courses on your open courseware site?
Yes.
Is that different?
No. It's just the course that I taught over the summer. So it's an archive. The open courseware is an archival repository. So I changed, the course gets changed so much. But it's a great resource for students who want to go in and say, what's this course like? All the different genres of video games, and do I find them challenging to think about? Do certain disciplines fit better? Yeah, I mean, there's so many variety of games, but this is where, you know, this isn't, it's a video game-like in its structure, but not, the elements could be video game-like. I mean, depending on what your performance objectives were, you could add elements of a simulation, you know, and the whole course could be a simulation. But when I'm talking more about is the structure of how the learning is paced, and how the information to the student is delivered. So I could easily see a course designed like a video game incorporate a lot of video game-like elements into it. I mean, video modules, you know, that would be simulations or other kinds of game elements. I hope I answered your question. Okay. It comes to 210 using internet communications. It's currently published to the open courseware site at UMass Boston.
How much time did it take you to do all this? My concern is for a faculty who don't have the background experience, how easy it is to do something.
I think it's pretty easy because if you're teaching an online course in particular, it's front-loaded. It's a very different kind of way of designing experiences, unlike the classroom where you have to do it all in advance and you have to think about the paces. So if you do that, I mean, my course has evolved over time. I would say if I was going to start from the very beginning, I'd probably want to allow like 2 solid weeks of designing a course. But the benefit is when I'm actually teaching it is not as it's not as time intensive. And I also, you know, I tweak it after it's taught and stuff, but pretty much it's very modular, so I can take out elements and replace them, but I don't have to replace the whole course. So usually I'm just taking, okay, I'm going to take out week 2's activities because now something else has become more important.
Wonderful.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Glad you thought so. Thanks.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Outsourced hosting of multi-format digital media content is available from Real's own CDN, the Real Broadcast Network. Information at rbn.com.